This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, part two of our discussion about Sudan's descent into violence. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. What will it take to stop the war, which threatens to plunge not only Sudan into total chaos, but also roil and destabilize the entire Horn of Africa region? Why did two rival generals, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan of Sudan's Armed Forces, or the SAF, and Lieutenant General Mohamed Hamdan, also known as Hemedti, commander of the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, abandon the roadmap, which called for the consolidation of their forces and the transition to democracy? Last week, the Wall Street Journal reported, quote, "The conflict in Sudan has disrupted the supply of a little-known but crucial ingredient in Coca-Cola, chocolate bars, red wine, and many other products, sparking concerns over shortages later in the year," close quote. This begs the question, despite the fact that the deadly power struggle between the East African nation's top generals has claimed over 500 lives, left thousands injured, and displaced many more, will it take the disruption in the supply of gum arabic, 80% of which is produced by Sudan's acacia trees and the key ingredient in Coca-Cola, to finally catalyze action? Kidding aside, it does make one wonder what it will take to stem the senseless killing, looting, and overall destruction, which has been felt disproportionately in Khartoum and the Darfur region. Ceasefires are declared and then promptly broken. On Thursday, U.S. President Joe Biden signed an executive order authorizing sanctions on people who, quote, "threaten the peace, security, or stability of the country," close quote. The violent power struggle comes amid maneuvering among Sudan's neighbors, the West and Russia, for influence and advantage in this strategic African country. Seven countries border Sudan: Egypt, Libya, Chad, Central African Republic, Eritrea, South Sudan, and Ethiopia. More than 100,000 refugees have fled Sudan, and hundreds of thousands have been displaced internally, according to UN officials. For more on the Sudan crisis, we turn to two top former U.S. diplomats. Tibor Nagy is former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs during the Trump administration, and Ambassador Donald Booth. He was U.S. Ambassador to Ethiopia, Liberia, and Zambia, and also served as Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan. And both gentlemen join me via Microsoft Teams. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you, Carol.
First to you, Ambassador Nagy. Why do you think this violence erupted? What are the factors that led to this violence just as the country was on this brink of a democratic transition?
First of all, I don't think it was on the brink of a democratic transition. I think the international community may have projected onto them this thought that they were going to be unifying their forces and pushing forward with a transition. I don't think either gentleman had in mind that that's what was going to happen. I think between the two of them, there can only be one number one. And neither one wants to be number two. They have forces at their disposal. They have their own internal pressures from their own constituencies. So I think the world was somewhat naive in thinking that this was going to happen flawlessly. There have been very negative signs for weeks on maneuvering and moving of forces. So it's the two of them. And as I have said before, there are no angels here.
Turning to you, Ambassador Booth, do you also believe that the world was rather naive, that there were negative signs for weeks, that in fact these generals' rivals would never really agree to this?
There was certainly the potential, if a way could be found, that both of them could preserve enough of their power and particularly their economic interests in order to be able to compete in a new democratic process in Sudan. And that's what I think the international community was pushing for, was to get a civilian transition, get a democratic process going. And it didn't necessarily require the full exclusion of either the SAF or the RSF. That was never really feasible. These guys hold real hard power. But the idea is that over time, they could be convinced that their interests could be preserved enough that they would not have to resort to what they have, which is fighting each other and basically pushing any hope of civilian government aside for the foreseeable future.
Back to you, Ambassador Nagy. Can you help us understand what may have gone wrong historically?
Sure.
In terms of why this hasn't materialized.
Well, first of all, let me give kudos to my friend and colleague, Ambassador Donald Booth, because I don't think anybody worked harder to make this succeed than he did. And I think that the world had a wonderful opportunity when Prime Minister Hamdok was the face of the Sudanese government. You know, we called it a civilian-led transitional government. It wasn't really civilian-led, but Prime Minister Hamdok was doing a phenomenal job. And unfortunately, I have to say honestly that neither the United States nor the international community stepped up and supported him to the extent that he needed to be supported, because if he had been, then we would be in a different place now, because yes, he would have been very much the third member of that team, but bit by bit, with proper policies, he could have slowly stepped to the front. Unfortunately, we didn't. He was thrown out of office in October 2021, and since then, it has been a renegade regime. So looking back, I am just very, very sorry that, number one, the United States could not move faster, and number two, Prime Minister Hamdok did not have the support that he needed.
Turning to you, Ambassador Booth, for you to help us understand why the United States and other members of the international community didn't sufficiently support Abdullah Hamdok and that democratic revolution that we saw by the people who overthrew Omar al-Bashir. And then, unfortunately, we had the coup in 2021. What do you think went wrong?
Well, I fully agree with what Ambassador Nash said. And not enough was done to support Prime Minister Hamdok and his predominantly civilian transitional government. Number of reasons for that. One, everybody was starting in Sudan with a very small diplomatic and assistance platform. And it takes time to ramp up, to get people in place, to be able to provide the type of advice and support needed. Second is the budget cycle problem. When the civilian-led transition government came into power, we had, I think, about $6 million budgeted for Sudan. That wasn't going to go very far in helping Hamdok show the Sudanese people that civilian government could deliver. I think we scrounged up roughly up to about $30 million in that first year. Now, even later, we got more money after Sudan joined into the Abraham Accord, $700 million, plus debt relief promises, et cetera, but that never got dispersed before the October 21 coup. There was always this sense of the fear of another Burma, that we were going to support a transitional civilian government, but the military still held a lot of the cards, and they might just take over, so therefore we needed to hedge our bets. This is a self-fulfilling prophecy. We're not going to support the civilians because the military might take over, and because we don't support the civilians enough, the military does take over. And I fear that that could well happen again. There's some blame, I think, also to go to the fact that we offered no way forward for the Sudanese military to see that they could have a productive relationship with us either, for various reasons, obviously, given the backgrounds of the RSF in particular, but also the Sudanese armed forces in the Darfur conflict. But the point was that they didn't see that they had much to gain by the game plan that we were pushing, which was the civilian-led transition. Prime Minister Hamdok wasn't a politician. He's an economist. He didn't reach out to the base of Sudanese people, the resistance committees, the students, the women who were behind the revolution. And so he didn't build a political base that he needed. The regional powers that came together that helped get this power-sharing deal between military and civilians in August of 2019, that frayed as they saw civilians squabble, and their interest was stability. And they began to think that maybe they had backed the wrong horse. And then finally, I think another blow to the civilian government was the role that the Juba Peace Agreement signatories. These were people who were supposedly fighting for the same ideals of democratic governance in Sudan. And yet after they signed the peace agreement and came to Khartoum, they basically became supporters of more of the military than of Prime Minister Hamdok and the civilian transition. So that brings us to the coup of October 2021. After that, pundits have all said that the United States should have sanctioned all these people, but would those sanctions have been effective? Those people were supported by the region, by the very people who enabled the gold to flow out of Sudan, who were providing the budget support that kept the military government functioning. So what we did, I think, was just the right thing. We worked with the regional powers. We tried to get the parties to start talking and to get a new transitional process on track. Unfortunately, it did unravel over this issue of security sector reform. And again, our aversion to dealing with the security sector meant we were not a particularly effective player in that issue.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you are listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. My guests are Ambassador Tibor Nagy, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, and Ambassador Donald Booth, from whom you just heard. He's former U.S. Ambassador to Ethiopia and Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan. And we are discussing the implications of renewed conflict in Sudan. Back to our special guests in this very important topic, Sudan. So back to you, Ambassador Nagy. Let's go to how to go forward. I would like you to comment on President Biden's executive order on Thursday authorizing sanctions on people who threaten the peace, security, or stability of the country, undermine its democratic transition, and use violence against civilians or commit serious human rights abuses. Will that precipitate any kind of change for the better?
It may make Washington feel better, but I don't think it's going to make any difference on the ground. I mean, it is absolutely a very positive step on the part of the White House, but I think that those kinds of initiatives really reflect the incredible frustration in Washington, not just from the executive branch, but also from the legislative branch. And whenever these kind of things happen, there's always tremendous pressure to, quote unquote, do something. But as far as changing the behavior on the ground or even having a major impact, I'm not sure how many of the people involved in this conflict care about the dollar system. People can find ways to bypass the dollar system. So it looks good. It sounds good. But I really don't think it's going to make much of a difference. But it certainly puts the United States firmly on the side of taking some kind of a positive step to try to end this thing. I'm a real pessimist on this entire conflict, and I fear that it's going to be more symbolic than effective.
More symbolic than effective, Ambassador Booth?
Well, the effectiveness of any sanctions or arms embargo, which has, I think, also been discussed in some quarters, it really depends on whether the people that need to enforce it are on board. We can do a lot, obviously, with our control of the dollarized economy of the world, but there are limits to that. A lot of business is being done in neighboring states in the Middle East. And I think the engagement that we've had with all of those parties to try to get the Sudanese to the negotiating table to agree to a ceasefire really needs to include talk about how to increase the pressure on the parties to get them to do what everybody's saying they should do, which is stop the fighting and get to the table and talk how to put Sudan back together again.
Well, back to you, Ambassador Nagy. Who can do that? Who can bring these parties to the table? We know there are a number of mediators, whether it's the East African Organization, IGAD, Kenyan President William Ruto. We hear about South Sudan's president, the AU, the UN. I mean, there's a lot of parties here, but who's really able to communicate and get to these generals to, one, have an effective ceasefire? Because there's ceasefires and then they're broken right away, not to mention a longer term strategy for stability.
Yeah, here's the deal. We look at Sudan and it really is literally the crossroads between the Middle East and Africa. So you have keen interest from the side of the Middle East and from the side of Africa. You mentioned United Nations, African Union, IGAD, then the Gulf Arabs, then you have the neighboring countries, then you have the Quad, the United States, United Kingdom. There is literally a traffic jam of peace proposals. And whether that is productive or counterproductive, we'll see. Okay, maybe if every foreign minister in the world is calling up these two people, that'll keep them on the phone so they can't issue orders. But at this point, that's about the maximum extent of good that all of these peace proposals being independent of each other do. The world needs to, number one, show some unity. Who is going to engage with them? Who is going to send the message? It has to be the same message. And by the way, it can be in public giving one message and then doing wink, wink. Oh, by the way, yeah, we're saying that you have to stop fighting. But yes, a shipment of arms is on the way and it's going to land at this air base. So the regional countries have their interests. The regional countries are also greatly concerned about the instability spilling over into their borders. There are so many forces at work that the international community, if it's going to be effective, they absolutely have to be united on this. And at the end of the day, no matter how many international initiatives there are, the two protagonists have to be willing to stop fighting. Because until the two of them are willing to do it, as long as they have their hands-on weapons, as long as they're being financed, as long as they're getting tremendous pressure from their own constituents, currencies because of their economic interests. The fighting is going to go on, and countries are going to issue statement after statement after statement, kind of like with the Northern Ethiopia war, and nothing is going to happen until they're exhausted.
So Ambassador Booth, Ambassador Nash talked about a traffic jam of peace proposals. That is simply, you know, not enough. The various parties need to show unity. But my fear is, and I'd like to get your take on this, is that we're looking at, as Ambassador Nash said, just a real mishmash of interests, you know, the Gulf Arabs, the African Union, etc. And I have a funny feeling that a transition to democratic rule is not a high priority for Saudi Arabia, for the UAE, or for Egypt. Correct me if I'm wrong. And that's what I'm concerned about. What will it take for them to come to at least some consensus on stability?
You just hit the key word, which is stability. When I started back in 2019, trying to bring parties together in Sudan, it was the region and everybody in the region, the Egyptians, the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Qataris, IGAD, the African Union, they all wanted stability in Sudan. They do not have stability now, that's for sure. They will have even less stability if this war metastasizes, spills over into other countries, becomes an entrenched ethnic-based civil war. So I think everybody's interest in stability is what we need to build on, and which I believe the United States is working on right now, which is trying to bring the various components together. There's two ways you can go about this. You can try to get everybody beforehand to say, let's all get behind one proposal mediator and then kind of tell the Sudanese they have to work with that. Or we can say, here, everybody is out there offering mediation. Let the Sudanese decide who they will actually sit down with and then get behind that. And I think that second scenario is the more likely one to play out. But it's absolutely important that there be unity of the key players. And there, I think it's the Gulf states and Egypt and the United States can really play that facilitative role. And I think what I've seen is we are trying to do that. And we put a lot of high-level attention into that, and I hope that will continue.
That's a key concept, a facilitative role, Ambassador Nash. Do you agree that the United States can play that role and bring these disparate interests together? And then what about spoilers like Russia or the Wagner Group? I think the Russians, the government itself, are backing General al-Burhan of the Sudan Armed Forces, whereas the Wagner Group seems to be backing Hemeti's group, the Rapid Support Forces, and exporting gold and pillaging Darfur. How do you see that?
First of all, I absolutely agree with Don. That second method would be the one that would be the most effective, again, if the two protagonists are ready to move forward on this, because the United States does well in being a facilitator and a supporter. We are not that good at, you know, what I would say a transactional deal where we sit down with people and look them in the eye and say, you have to do X, Y, and Z. We don't work that way. But being facilitator, example, Northern Ethiopia, you know, Mike Hammer and the U.S. played a phenomenally positive role in helping end that. As far as Russia's concerned, I honestly would be very uncomfortable to be in the position of Russia, because if they end up backing the wrong side, then their interests in Sudan could just go down the drain. I mean, you know, Russia for years has been trying to finalize a deal for a naval base in Port Sudan. So in that regard, they have established dealings with General Burhan. So the Russian government has to think about the possibility of General Burhan and the Sudanese armed forces coming out ahead. But at the same time, as you mentioned, Wagner, there is pretty strong evidence that Hemeti and the RSF has had dealings with Wagner with joint gold shipments and the seizure of the plane with gold that was labeled as cookies at Khartoum Airport and things like that. And then the potential links with Haftar in Libya. Haftar has definite links with Wagner. And so the official Russia is going to be kind of sitting on the fence and making sure that they don't back the wrong side. But then behind the curtain, I think you definitely will have Wagner. And as we have seen in Ukraine, they tend to pursue their own selfish interests. So, you know, we'll wait and see how this plays out.
Ambassador Booth, do you think that these two generals, can they remain as players because they couldn't implement the framework agreement from 2021 to integrate the armed forces? So are they going to be part of the solution?
Well, they're players with hard power right now, so they have to be part of the solution. There's no way to get around that. The question is, one, getting them to start talking and stop fighting. And then the next and the really hard hurdle will be, what's the solution? What is it that they are going to be willing to give up. Will their supporters abandon them if they give up too much? I mean, I think one of the problems we've had is they've always had to be looking over their shoulder at where their support is coming from. And I think General Burhan has had particularly a problem with the fact that the Sudan Armed Forces, the SAF, is loaded with Bashir loyalist Islamist officers who've been recruited into the ranks over the past 30 years. So even if Burhan wanted to support fully the 2019 constitutional transition of power, he would have had difficulty from these elements. And I think that explains why we've often seen him take one step forward and three quarters of a step backward. You know, he agrees to the framework agreement, and then he says, oh, but we need all these other parties to join it. And then when the civilians hold tough and say, no, we're not letting the former Bashir folks into the discussion, the spoilers in that will just blow the thing up, he moves forward and he sounds reasonable. And then there's the problem with Hemeti and the security sector reform, the integration of forces. So they're going to be players. They have to be dealt with. But I think the point is we do have tools if we have the support of the key regional players to put enough pressure on them to give Sudan a chance for a new way forward, a way that will enable Sudan to be the stable country that everybody wants.
And then the same question to you, Ambassador Naj. Do you see these two generals eventually implementing an agreement? And where do the civilians stand? Former Prime Minister Hamdok, is he around? Is he a player? Is there somebody who speaks for the long-suffering civilians?
You know, you asked a key question, and Don said something very important just a while ago when he said that Hamdok's heart was definitely in the right place, willing to give up so much for his country, but he was not a smooth operator politician. And from the civilian side, you're going to have somebody that has the skills, and it's going to take a long, long time, but to take Sudan forward bit by bit, reduce the power of the military in a way that they are accepting of it, they understand it. And at the same time, the resistance committees have also been a problem because they have been purists. And if you remember, they were a thorn in the side of Prime Minister Hamdok because they felt like he needs to be moving much, much quicker when he really couldn't be. So I think the resistance committees and the civilians have to be somewhat realistic and understand that things are not going to happen immediately, and they will have to be willing to trade the perfect and accept the good, because otherwise we're going to be on a vicious cycle. As I said before, right now I'm very pessimistic. I totally agree with Ambassador Booth that these two players are the key players, and there's no way that the international community is going to elbow them out of the way, because they're the ones who count right now, unless somebody's willing to come up with $2 billion to pay each of them to retire to the Seychelles and just leave Sudan. So it's going to be extremely complicated, and maybe Don knows some of the civilian players who might be possibilities, but I don't know of anybody who can right now step into the position and do all of these incredible, difficult tasks that need to be done.
Well, as we close, Ambassador Booth, you know, we're witnessing also the conflict has spilled over into Sudan's Darfur region, and many worry that this could ignite prolonged fighting in that area, dredging up those horrific memories of the Janjaweed, who are the base of the RSF, Hemeti's group. And then we know that many diplomats, so all of the diplomats have left, you know, the Americans that have fled for their own safety. To what extent is that a liability in providing the support that Sudan needs so much at this moment? And then, of course, the refugee crisis threatens to further destabilize the region. This has got to worry everyone and hopefully be a catalyst for the parties you mentioned to work toward stability and a stop to this fighting.
Well, as we saw in Ukraine, you know, we pulled our diplomats out, but we put them back in as soon as we felt that it was safe to do so. Diplomats hunkered down in the basement of an embassy can't really do anything. So it's actually better use of their skills and their contacts to have them out where they can at least operate to a certain extent. We will reengage diplomatically in Sudan when it's possible to do so without putting people's lives directly at risk. The other thing I think we need to keep in mind is that this is not just Generals Burhan and Hemeti. They represent elements of Sudanese society. Burhan and the SAF represent the traditional rulers of Sudan, the center, the Nile Valley, the Arabized, if you will, Sudanese, the people the Egyptians most associate with. Hemeti represents the pastoralists Arabized tribes of Darfur. It does not represent all of Darfur. There are African agriculturalist tribes that are there. They were the ones who bore the brunt of the genocide and are now bearing the brunt, I think, of renewed fighting in Darfur. They're caught in this crossfire between the SAF and the RSF, just as the people of Khartoum are. So there's an element really of a civil war here, of center versus periphery. And Sudan needs to find a political accommodation that can accommodate center and periphery without it being one completely dominating the other. And that's the real challenge, and that's why there has to be political negotiations that come out of this. In terms of a civilian political leader, I think Prime Minister Hamdok has had his shot at it. He does not have a political power base in Sudan. But unfortunately, most of the other civilian political players are tied to political parties that really represent their interests. And they need to come together and really form an effective civilian bloc working with the resistance committees, because that's really a much more genuine voice of the Sudanese people.
That's about all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Ambassador Tibor Nagy, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, and Ambassador Donald Booth, former U.S. Ambassador to Ethiopia and Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.